Before we get started with this episode, I wanted to let you know that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. In honor of this, I'm making my signature course, Resiliency Sprint, 50% off just for podcast listeners. You also get lifetime access to CBT Family Toolbox, over 100 activities, resources, and ideas to bring cognitive behavioral tools to your family. Head to childanxietysupport.com/resiliencysprint to learn all about this foundational course. And when you sign up, use code PODCAST to get 50% off both the coached and uncoached versions. This offer is only good till May 31st, so make sure you sign up now. Hey everyone, welcome to the first You Are Not Your Mother podcast for 2022. And I have a treat for you in this first interview of the year. I'm talking with Erin Upchurch, who is a licensed social worker here in Central Ohio. Erin is the executive director of the Kaleidoscope Youth Center, which is a drop-in center for LGBTQIA+ youth and their allies, and is also the co-founder of the Ohio REST Collective, which offers a variety of services for individuals, groups, and organizations seeking to foster equity, inclusion, and harm reduction. Erin shares her own journey towards healing and wellness, and that is really why I reached out to interview her for this podcast. Erin is upfront and honest about what she's gone through and how she's grown. She is this incredibly impressive woman, this woman who has done some really terrific things here in our community. And she's also struggled because she's human, and she talks open and honestly about that. Hopefully that will inspire all of us who are also struggling to learn and grow and heal, because we're all works in progress. And the more that we own that and talk about that, then the more we can live out our honest reality and also inspire others to live out their honest reality. The theme for this month is rest, and I'm choosing that because, well, 2020 was quite a year, 2021 was quite a year, and 2022 is shaping up to also be quite a year. All of the challenges that we have dealt with individually, in our families, in the community, in our society, have really highlighted the dysfunction of our systems. And Erin talks about that, but also talks about how we ourselves can really take control of our own experience and sort of wiggle in and make room for what it is that we need in the context of things that are outside of our control. So the word for January is rest. And let's dive into the interview with Erin and learn more about what she has to say about that. Hi, Erin. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Can you tell everybody a little bit more about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So my name's Erin. I use she, her pronouns. I am a social worker. I'm in my 21st year social. Yeah, 21st year. I know. I don't. Yeah.
Because you started when you were 12, apparently.
Exactly. Yes. Early. A prodigy. I am the executive director for Kaleidoscope Youth Center, which is a statewide organization that serves LGBTQI+ youth and young adults ages 12 to 24. I'm adjunct faculty at the OSU College of Social Work. I do a lot of my courses are around the diversity and cultural competency and working and doing community practice. I consider myself an integrative community practitioner. I am a yoga teacher. I have two children. I have a 17-year-old daughter starting her senior year, and then a 19-year-old son who's in his sophomore year of college.
Oh my gosh.
There's one more thing. And I have a business with my partner called the Ohio REST Collective. And we essentially work with individuals, groups, and systems regarding their relationship with rest and well-being. And I know we can talk more about that a little bit later, but that's doing leadership development trainings and doing some strategic planning, some different consultation things with organizations.
I find it ironic that you had the REST Collective when I question whether or not you ever have any time to rest.
Right? I have gotten asked that a lot about like work-life balance, which I don't think is a real thing. I do rest. I take naps often. I ease into my days. Like even if I'm up at 8 or 9, I don't usually get started around 11, maybe 10 if needed. And so for me, rest isn't just about the physical act of closing our eyes and sleeping, but it's about this inner stillness and this inner grounding and my nervous system being at rest. So I'm not in fight or flight mode all the time. And because of that and being able to stay regulated, the work I'm doing feels very generative and I feel the most alive when I'm doing it.
So you said you don't believe in work-life balance. Tell me what you mean by that.
As a woman, I've been a single mom. I've also been partnered as a parent. And I know there's, especially with women, they talk about this work-life balance and how you can do it all. And you can't. I just don't think it's true. And I wish you would stop selling that as an opportunity or an option. And so when I think about, often balance is like this, the scales are balanced. And sometimes one end is going to be a little higher or lower than the other one. And it's, for me, it's been about finding the most generative space I get to be in. And so sometimes that means a little more attention. I'm deep diving into work or special projects. And sometimes my sink fills up with dishes until the weekend. Right? Or I'm helping my kids or I'm doing something and I might miss a deadline every now and then. It's juggling. It's more of a juggling act. So I guess if that's a balance, but it's, I'm also fortunate to do work that I said is so generative. So it doesn't always feel like work. It's not always draining me. And on the weekends, I try not to check email and respond to things. So I guess that's a choice and that's being intentional about my time. But I think the word balance is a misnomer and people are harming themselves and wearing themselves out trying to achieve it. And then they get guilty and all these other stories come along with that.
I love that because I always tell clients that balance is a verb. And so sometimes you're going to be tipped. When you have a 2-year-old who's getting their molars, you are not going to be in balance because you're not going to be getting enough sleep. That kid is going to be so demanding. That's just the reality. It's not, it doesn't mean you're doing it wrong.
It doesn't. And I also think for the proverbial balance, you need resources. And most of us don't have all the resources we need for that perfect balance. I think I think about this with trauma too, and learning about being regulated and recovery is not about not getting activated. It's about being able to go back and forth and find a sweet spot. Perhaps in the middle. And some days you're a little closer to the full activation and you need different care. And some days you're on cloud 9 and you're like, what trauma? And so I think life is what happens in between and getting to a place to deal with the ups and downs and the flows and even the times where you just feel stuck and immobilized. Like that's actually what's real. And I wish we could give people more tools to do things that way instead of focusing on this balance.
You have said so many good things there. So I have to think about where I want to start and make sure I don't forget the other things I want to ask. And one is, can you explain what you mean by activated when you're talking about trauma?
Sure. When I talk about activation, it's also the word trigger. I'm a little rebel and everybody says trigger and I don't want to say it, but it's similar. It's our bodies. It's an adaptive response to something related to a traumatic experience. And we know, I don't want to assume, but we know trauma is anything basically that's too much for our systems. And there's so many layers, so many different types. I actually have a diagnosis. I use that loosely because it's not in the DSM, but of CPTSD, which is around the prolonged stress of certain things and some childhood stuff. And so an activation for me that I actually have learned through relationships is a fear of abandonment, fear of rejection. And so what that looks like, if my partner and I are having an argument or something's hard and they step outside, I need to know when they're coming back. And if I don't know, I might get activated. And what that feels like for me and what that looks like for me is a panic attack. And it can spiral to that. It doesn't always get there. And activation though can happen anytime. It could happen in the grocery store where we start breathing heavily. Maybe we notice our heart rate is increasing or we're tense or there's anxiety. There's a whole list of adaptive strategies that people use just to get through the day. In younger folks, it can be defiance because you just want to have control over your life. It could be come out of depression, anxiety. So I think there's so many, I'm hesitant to just put activation in one container, but it really is here's what I'll say. I call it my survivor vigilante fights for me. And she will show up with her cape and everything and will do what she has to do to make sure I feel okay. And it is not always in my conscious best interest, but she thinks it is. And that's the activation for me when my survivor vigilante wakes up and is what's going on. Gets hypervigilant, perhaps, asks a lot of questions. And so there's a way to live in relationship with my survivor vigilante where, hey girl, we're okay. Because I know how to, I can check my facts. It's safe here. Like, we're good. Thank you. We're okay.
I like the way you're framing this is one, it makes sense in the mm-hmm. context of your experience. And two, it's not a failure.
No.
It's not a sign you're broken. It's a sign actually that you're functioning.
Absolutely. And my goodness, how magical and miraculous are our nervous systems and our brains to know, like, I'm gonna keep us safe. That's actually a really beautiful thing. And you're right, we're actually functioning the way we're supposed to. Some of us just have more armor than the others. Some of us have different tools than the other people do, but there's nothing wrong. We don't want to live there.
Right. And like you said, sometimes it's not consciously the mm-hmm. choice you might want to make. And so what you're talking about is learning to take care of that. Are you partnering with that part of yourself then?
We're working on it. I would say more now than ever. I started doing some deep trauma work in 2019. And I would say last year is when I was like, oh, that's what this is. It's this survivorship within me. And that's not to say I'm not accountable. I'm not responsible. It's not my fault if I harm somebody in my own response. So that means I get to be committed to the repair afterwards. But I definitely, the awareness of something's coming up for me. Here's an example. Last week, my partner and I were having a conversation. There was something that was coming up for me. And I was able to say, you know what? There's actually no threat here and I'm okay. It might feel the same, but it's not. And so that's me working in partnership with that part of me to say, we're good. Because I could feel her starting to come out and look around and I'm like, we're okay. But that's because I have the tools to acceptance of a feeling. I'm not saying, don't feel this. I can accept it. And then I get curious. And then I learn to check my facts. And then there's other tools that I've gotten through my own just practice and being in therapy that allow me to partner in that way. And there's the balance. That's that work. That's the thing in between that where I can settle somewhere, hopefully more in the middle.
What made you realize that you wanted to do more work around this? You said you started doing this heavy lifting in 2019.
So 2017 actually was a hard year. I turned 40 and I had the fun word is spiritual awakening, but it felt like a midlife crisis. I was like, oh, that's what this is. Like literally dawn on a Tuesday afternoon, I was driving a minivan. I was like, I don't want to drive a minivan. And I just went and got a new car. And I was like, oh, now I get it. The convertibles. I didn't feel right there. And I also ran for office that year. And there was something about the exposure and shifting from being a parent in the way that I was used to parenting, which is, I don't want to say fully present because I'm still present, but it wasn't what my kids enjoyed or were used to. I would be the mom that got made breakfast at 6 o'clock in the morning for teenagers. And I'm like, y'all can do it. So it was all of that happening where things just started rising to the surface. I just felt very raw. I got a divorce that year because I was like, this isn't who I want to be. I'm not happy. I'm not fulfilled. I don't know if it's reactive. I was in a relationship at the time too, that wasn't after the divorce that wasn't healthy. I would probably use the word abusive if talking to someone else. And so I think it was this culmination of all these different changes, shifts, engaged in harm, that I felt like where I felt like I was okay, I wasn't, like the dam had broken. And I started having like panic attacks, like spiraling into panic attacks. If there was a fight with a person I was dating at the time, depression, oh my gosh, I was deep in depression. Two of my super close friends and activists in the community passed away within, you know, a few months of each other. Like it sucked me under. And there was one episode where I was on my couch for about 5 days and I didn't shower. I don't think I was eating. And I didn't want to live like that. Like I couldn't because I still had kids and I still had a job and I still had to function and all of that. And so just beginning to know that I needed to do something. I will say I have a history of depression. I had postpartum depression with my kids. My family has a history of mental illness. And so the feelings weren't new to me. I imagine if I'd never experienced it before, I might have maybe responded differently, but I knew, oh, this is going nowhere fast. And in doing that work, with a therapist, I realized a lot of this is trauma related. And I was like, let's do it. So this, it took me 2 years to get to a point of let's just do it. I chose EMDR because I am also a therapist and I know how to talk and I know how to wrap things around the therapist so they get the answers. And I didn't want that. I wanted to be in my integrity and my healing.
There's a couple things I really like about this. And one of them is people always think therapists have it together, but I think many of us come to the work of therapy because we don't have it together, because we have histories of family trauma, because we have histories of our own trauma, and we're trying to figure it out. So your therapist does not necessarily know more than you. Right. They're there to help you discover what you need to know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, your therapist probably does not have it all together. Maybe she does. Maybe they do.
I don't think she does. And here's the thing too, is I'm probably about 15 years older than her. And so even, and I wasn't like, oh, this isn't going to work. But I know I needed something specific. And I went in, I was like, look, this is what I do. This is what I know. And I need you to not be intimidated by that. And let's do this. And it's done wonders for me. But I don't think it's about us having it all together. No one has it all together. No, not one person in this world does.
No. And the minute you think you do, something in your life will happen. Absolutely. Because life gives you just so many wonderful opportunities for growth, whether you wanted it or not.
Like a and, yeah.
And I think maybe the difference between therapists and not everybody, but the thing is about therapists is we have decided that we are going to be curious about growing. Yes. And we're going to welcome it. So obviously there's exceptions, but maybe your therapist is just a little more hell-bent on personal growth, maybe.
Yeah, I think that, and I also, and I believe other therapists are around this too, is I feel very strongly about people having access. So when I talked about that wellness and that rest and that space on the inside, that inner stillness, I know it's available. I know it's possible because I've experienced it and I want other people to be connected to that. There's these memes going around about being called resilient and don't ever call me that. I wanted you to say these other things and building a life from which you don't need a break. And I live it, it's challenging at times, but I want that. I really want that for everybody. I do believe it's possible regardless of the circumstances. It just looks different.
Yeah, you mentioned resources before. Can you also talk about that? Because I think people often blame themselves for things that are outside of their control. They don't have the same kind of access.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's definitely the tangible resources of finances or health insurance. And so being able to pay for therapy, especially. And I was going weekly for probably about 6 months, six copay each time. So that's a resource and I have access to that. And I have health insurance that covers the rest of it. And I have a job that I can go to therapy and it's not a big deal. So those are just some really basic things. And because my children are older and independent, I don't have to worry necessarily about getting someone picked up from daycare. Mm-hmm. Although my daughter was three, I took a nap and was an hour late one time, but recovered just
fine. Did you have to pay $60 for that dollar a minute thing?
They did not make me pay that, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. I was mortified. I was so mortified. She was the last one there. Anyway, but there's other resources. So it's having supportive people in your life. Because therapy, we know, is not for everybody, or counseling or whatever modalities. But it's having people in your life who can reflect the truth about who you are to you, who can see you, who know you, who love you, whether that's partnership or family or friends, even the knowledge that there's something else available. Not everybody knows that something else is available or possible, or they don't believe it because they haven't seen it. Having the inner resources of, because I'm a yoga practitioner and I'm a Reiki practitioner and polarity. And so those are all tools and resources on top of my education, lived experience, financial, all those things. And some folks don't have any of that. Some have just a couple of them. And I think when I look at social problems, I am always just like, if we just meet basic needs, we can see different things. And so when I was in the deep depression, I wasn't eating. I was sleeping a lot and not even bathing, but I had my sister, and oddly enough, my ex-wife would come over every single day and sit with me and just sit. We didn't even talk because I knew I wasn't alone. But if I was alone, that could have gone a different way. And so those are resources as well.
You were saying that you have parented both with a partner and as a single parent. And I know there are single parents listening to this right now and are maybe feeling very alone. Mm-hmm. What might you say to that person as they're listening?
The first thing I would say is, I just felt very tender and emotional. That was interesting. I would say it's hard. And I say that to validate it. I know I see people sometimes talk about, oh, my spouse went out of town. I was a single parent for the weekend. Absolutely not. You were not. It's hard. And I would say, give yourself grace. Know that you're doing the best you can. And you're going to make some mistakes. Love your children the best that you can. There's no magic formula for being a single parent. It feels unfair, like an injustice at times. And our culture doesn't support single parents in the way that they don't support parents really at all, and especially single parents, regardless of how you got to be single as a parent. Yeah, I don't even actually have too many encouraging words other than validating and standing with them. And it's hard. And there are so many joys. I enjoy, and this is me looking back, but not having to ask anybody else how I'm going to raise my kids. Like, I'm going to do what I want to do. Right? Like, I chose attachment style parenting, and that was what I wanted to do. So I was able to explore things and not have to worry about a partner. Like, I don't want to do that. Like, I took advantage of that, and I was able to see it as, I'm not going to say a gift, but it was an opportunity to do things that I wanted to do them. And so there are joys in there as well. It's hard. It's just really hard, man. I don't even know what else to say. It's hard from like a day-to-day basis of just the basics. Like, I'm having visions coming back to me. Like I said, I picked my daughter up late from daycare when she was like 3, maybe 4. But that feeling of being awakened and there's nobody else to depend on. It was just me. And I let her down. Like, she thought she was forgotten. I can't. That was a hard recovery. I remember one time I lived out east and they were doing some work on the parking lot, but basically I couldn't park in front of our home. So I was a little ways down and it was raining and my kids were like, they're 20 months apart. So I think my oldest was maybe 3 at that time. And I had groceries and I was like, how am I supposed to get all this into the house? I didn't know. So I ended up locking the kids in the car. I took the groceries in and then walked back, and I'm soaked at this point. And I was like, I don't want to leave one here alone. So I had to carry 2 little ones. It's raining. It's dark. And I just remember just crying. I used to cry at night a lot on my own just to get them into bed. But that's also how I started doing co-sleeping. It was too hard to put them to just lay with me. Let's just go to sleep. Or at least I could sleep, but I knew they were safe or rest. Then there's many stories. And I know many single parents probably have similar experiences that they just don't talk about because people, one, you're embarrassed sometimes to say the things you had to do to survive, but 2, people don't truly get it unless they've been through it.
I think finding your people is so important. And of course, that's another thing that's very hard if you're a single parent. When do you have time to find your people? But I remember reading an interview with the woman who wrote Better Things, Pamela Adlon, I think is her name. Mm-hmm. And it's Better Things, right? Is that the name of the show? It's terrific though. And it's about her being a single mother. And the thing she said she really wanted to convey, even though in the show, she has a strong friend group, she has strong social support, is how lonely it is to be a single parent.
Yes, on so many levels. I went through grad school when my kids were 4 and 6 as a single parent. So I was going through grad school as well. And it's lonely. Not just from like a social perspective. Number one, not everybody else has parent kids or they have a spouse or the dilemma of childcare, all those things, like it's lonely. But then at night when the kids are asleep, it's typically just me. And there's no adult conversation. So even the things that I loved that I got to do on my own without considering somebody else, that's also a really lonely space too. Because you don't have things to bounce off of. And I want to parent one way, but there's another way that I need to parent for my kid, individualizing that. And there's nobody to bounce that off of. There's no one to get that reinforcement. And you don't know if you're doing a good job or not because it's just you. And it is extremely lonely.
I am just going to say that I think probably, I say this to everyone who's listening, who's a single parent, you're probably doing just a great job. You're doing Absolutely. A fine job, man. That is.
That's the truth though. One of my son's favorite meals was oatmeal and eggs. Cause I also didn't have a lot of money and we didn't eat meat. They were vegetarians when they were younger because I couldn't afford meat, but they loved macaroni and cheese and broccoli. That's just it. Like, you are doing a good job. They're safe. They're clean. They're having their childhood. But it's so hard to get outside of our heads and our minds and the stories and then all the external things that are going on to, like you said, you're doing great.
Yes. And every once in a while, Twitter will do, hey, what was your favorite struggle meal? And people will post their favorite struggle meal. And the important thing is people have a favorite struggle meal. They, as a four-year-old, weren't saying ketchup on white bread is gross. They were like, ketchup on white bread. It's only when we put some of these ideas onto how it, quote unquote, ought to be. Absolutely. But as you said, children are living their childhood and they don't know that they're missing out on, I don't know, ballet lessons or a treehouse or.
Yeah.
So we need to allow them to have the positive experience of their childhood because it belongs to them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would joke, like, they'll probably need therapy one day. And they did, but I don't think therapy is a bad
thing. We all need therapy. Right. No, that's, we're therapists. We're pro therapy.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. But again, that's not within our culture necessarily. And now I'm like, please go, whether you think anything's wrong, just go talk to somebody.
Right. Yeah. So you're saying that you're giving them, you're teaching them how to take good care of themselves. Right?
Absolutely. And the fact that both of my children and I can have conversations if they're not doing well, I'm like, oh, I did that right. Good job to me, because that's what I wanted. And so if there were something else, I would say on the other end is like, I don't want to say it gets better. I don't enjoy that phrase. And I think it's a false hope, but it changes. It definitely changes and shifts, and the load shifts as they get older.
So why do you say it's a false hope?
What is better? What does that even mean? I don't know. My oldest had some really tough difficulties in school around education and disabilities. And yeah, it gets better. And now he's 19 and I haven't heard from him in a couple of days. And I don't know what he's doing because he's an adult. So yeah, it gets better because I don't have to deal with high school stuff. But now I have an adult child that I'm learning the gift of surrender and how to navigate that. So one part might get better. It definitely changed.
It's what we said before. Life will keep giving you growing opportunities. I for myself, I think that raising young children is physically so exhausting. And then raising them to adulthood from the tween teen years on is emotionally so exhausting. So I am getting more sleep now, but I worry a lot more than I did when my daughter was 3.
Yeah, I've said before, I've never been able to be a stay-at-home parent, but if I could choose, it would definitely be during their adolescent years. Not the daycare is fun, playing with kids is fun, but the needs become so much more intense in adolescence, and being available and having that capacity absolutely is necessary.
Oh, right. But yeah, if you're on call, because you can't predict when they're all of a sudden gonna.
Yeah. For those who can't see, there's just hands going up because it's whatever. You can't predict anything.
Hang in there, people. Know that we're there for you. We're here too. So tell me about the Rest Collective. What is that?
The Rest Collective, as I mentioned at the beginning, is a business my partner and I started, I don't know, within the last year. I think it was the end of last year. We are both committed to that personal work. And it's interesting, we actually were doing a visioning activity one day where you lie down or sit down, look at the sky, and we like put our hands up like an openness. And we were doing this, and within 2 minutes, she sat up and she was like, restorative equity for sustainable transformation. And I was like, yes, let's talk about it. And that's the actual LLC, is restorative equity through sustainable transformation. And it's restoring, getting to that place of equity. We know not all things are equal, but if we can make things like rest equitable to people, make it accessible, it can be sustainable. It's not a quick fix of, hey, just go take a nap or go on vacation. It's not about the quick fix. We want the sustainability of rest, inner stillness, and feeling generative to happen. And we talk about transformation, and then I'll go into the shortened version of all this, but I, as a practitioner and a facilitator, practice transformative justice. And that's really around transforming the conditions that allowed harm to occur in the first place or that perpetuate it. It's also the systems within ourselves. And so it's doing that inner work so that you have sustainable transformation for your own life, your own livingness, whatever that is. And our core, the core work that we're doing is working with folks, supporting them in their relationship to rest, healing, and wellness. We do this through leadership coaching. Leadership is very lonely and it's exhausting. If you want to talk about being in fight or flight mode, leadership will do that to you. And then when you add all the intersections, like I'm a queer Black woman who's executive director of an organization in Columbus, Ohio. There's a lot there. And you can bring all my baggage from childhood on that too. And so being at a place of rest, I like to call it a sweet spot for me. I know what it feels like when I'm like presenting or at work and I'm in my place of rest because I am the truest version of who I am. And I'm able to breathe. And I'm able to make decisions, not from a place of scarcity or what's the other word I'm looking for? I'm not an adaptive strategy. So I'm not doing it for survival, it's for thriving. And that's on the individual level, working with coaching leaders to be able to get to that place. Where do you need to go inside of yourself to show up powerfully? Those are some of the questions we'll ask. We also do organizational development because organizations are living systems as well. And so we either work with their leaders or the entire organization to get to that place that when we say it's a safe place, is this really safer for your employees? What does it look like for this living system to have some room to breathe, to do the work that they're doing, to create that spaciousness? I've been using the term rest doula for myself. I love to look at people's lives and my poor partner, I always look at her and I'm like, give me your calendar, I can get you some rest. Like 2 weeks, I can look at somebody's schedule and be like, oh, this is what's draining you the most. But helping folks really align with the things that give them the most life. And that could look, and it can even not be possible or not feel possible to people, but it actually is, even in small doses. So that's the overarching vision for what we're doing. It also includes, like, I teach yoga classes. There's different opportunities. Karen, my partner, was doing things with young people last week, adolescents, around like using some stress balls, but just talking about things that matter to them and how they know safety. We believe that people can know safety within themselves, but I didn't learn that till probably 6 years ago, that I can know safety within my own body. I'm sure there's a lot of people walking around who do not know safety in their own body. And so it's taking all these modalities that we can't always put on paper, but we have these skills in supporting folks in the relationship with rest.
Can you define what you mean by generative?
And there's a couple of ways to look at generative. One is from think about a generator. If the lights go out, the generator kicks things back on. So it's like resource, it's a reserve. It keeps things running and keeps you going. Generative to me is really a felt sense of feeling myself and my own life, like feeling the most alive that I can, going back to this truest, the most beautiful form of myself, like not my best self, my favorite self. And it's the work and the relationships and the opportunities or the way I do my days that are generative. And so it's, you could also get it like a emotional bank account, if you will, like putting things in so that there are reserves, because I do have hard days, hard weeks, hard months, and having spaces to go. But there's something about connecting with people and work and whatever it is that just brings everything, the livelihood, to the surface. Like I feel it right now, and I wish I could put it in a cup and share it with you. Like, here, drink this and see what it feels like. But it's those moments where you truly are your favorite version of yourself and you feel the most free and the most ground. That's what happens when something is generative.
What a wonderful way to think of that. I like that so much better than best self. Best self is so judgmental.
So much pressure.
Yeah. And yeah. Favorite self, mm-hmm. It's so much more friendly.
It is.
And I know that those of us who have lived experience with any kind of trauma, but especially developmental trauma, complex trauma, are used to operating at a really high level of tension to the point that rest does not feel good to us.
No, it's rest.
Yes, it feels like, what can I do to rev things back up? So mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. And I've learned this the most through my relationship. And I remember talking to my therapist, I feel dumb that I'm learning so much through a partner relationship. Because again, as a woman, like nobody can define me. Nobody can do this. I'm independent, all these messages. And so some of my greatest lessons and experience of rest have been in my partnership, because it's about having a secure partnership. And there's attachment theories and basically how do we respond to stress. And because for me, my developmental relational trauma is around abandonment, rejection. I didn't know what a secure relationship felt like. And I forgot what you even asked me, but I'm going to keep talking about it. I remember one day my therapist said, "Do you have any secure relationships?" And it was a friend. And she said, "What makes that person feel secure?" And I said, "I don't feel like she's going to go anywhere if she knows the worst about me. I know that she's there, even if it's across town. Like, I know that person can be there." And I didn't feel like I had to hold on to anything. And there's something about being in a relationship that feels secure that allows me to rest. I don't have to be hyper vigilant. Sometimes I still am. I don't have to search for things. I can check facts, not in my own head, but I can say, "Hey, this is coming up for me," or "When you said, this is what I heard." And so that's that security. And that's what's actually allowed me to rest. And I truly feel like I'm very visual, but there's like a cloud that I can just lay back on. And so if I'm not always going or in my adaptive strategy, in my fight or flight mode, in my hypervigilance, that's actually one of my strongest adaptive strategies. And that's exhausting to notice everything that somebody's doing or not doing. If their eyes blink slower when they said this one thing than it did last time, like all of that. If that's what I'm focusing on, how can I focus on anything else in my own life, including myself? And I don't know what's real because I'm so focused on my external environment because there might be a threat. And so having that sense of security and that inner rest allows me to breathe, number one, which is so important. But there's something about not being on guard or in survival mode. And we know this just biologically and physiologically, cortisol and hormones and our amygdalas being on fire and telling us there's a fire all the time, all this physiological stuff, we know that impacts our health longer term even. And so we also look at rest as a place of like health and wellness longer term. If I can breathe more, keep my lungs open, right? Not have my shoulders up here, to where I'm going to have back pain later, like all these different things that show up in our bodies from trauma and prolonged stress, we can have different types of lives.
So if somebody wanted to add more rest to their lives, what would you say might be the first thing they might want to think about?
I would tell them to just start breathing, practice with conscious breathing. And here's why. Earlier this year, we were having a team meeting and we were just doing some collective breathing at the beginning. 3 minutes. 3 minutes was it. And there was nothing. They could go off screen. They didn't have to talk. And one of my team members was like, "I was just caught off guard. I wasn't prepared to spend time breathing." And I said, "What's happening in your life that breathing is inconvenient?" And so taking a few moments in the morning, maybe breathing and noticing your natural breath. There is nothing else you need to do. Our breath is just happening, and just focus on that for 3 minutes. And it can feel terrifying because it's stillness and we're so used to going. People will say meditation is hard for them, which is why I'm like, don't worry about meditation, just breathe. Yes, your mind might still be going and be very busy. That's okay. It's supposed to. Everything's working just fine. You're alive. But taking that time to just feel your own breath and set a timer, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And then you get to come back to that throughout your day. When things are going fast or feeling overwhelmed or escalating or whatever, we're being really human. We can always come back to our breath. I like to say it's like a inner river. We can come back to that place and just breathe and pause. That would be the first thing that I would suggest to anyone.
How can they then build on
doing it longer periods of time? I know this sounds really overly simplistic.
But it's not. You're exactly right. Because I know, as someone who had to learn to do this, that at the beginning, all I could think is, I could be doing something useful.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then you get to redefine usefulness and productivity and all of that stuff. Begin to just look at it. And it's not that things are right or wrong. We know a lot of folks are high producers, high achievers. The world itself keeps us going like this. And that's why Audre Lorde, she says, self-care is not indulgence. It's a political warfare, I believe. But it is, you are almost being radical and allowing yourself to breathe throughout your day in a meeting before you speak, before you put your feet on the floor in the morning, before you go back to in bed at night. And then redefining at some point, and that's where the support comes in, what is productivity even mean? And we've had the benefit of COVID, if you want to reframe, because I'm a social worker, I'm good at reframing. We got to slow down. The universe will sit down. You're gonna cook. You're not gonna be able to go outside. And so then finding those moments to where you have to do the work. Can you breathe while you're doing that work? Washing dishes is actually a really meditative experience if you're open to it. I just like to look out the window and wash, or I'll turn on a podcast or music while I'm cleaning up the kitchen. Like finding ways to incorporate that into your everyday tasks. And then you just, it gets good to you. The stillness. I am super protective of my time, even with my kids, like my door's closed. Please at least knock before you come in. Learning how to say no sometimes and set boundaries. And it's small things. My daughter asked me to make her a grilled cheese sandwich. And I was like, no, I just painted my nails. Right. But there's a time where I would have been like, yes, I mean, I would have made it work. And that might've meant messing up my nails. And so not choosing myself and what I did to regulate myself. And then I think for me, a place of rest and wellness is non-negotiable. That's in my workplace. That's in all that I do. And in my organization, because I am in charge, I get to create and cultivate environments and opportunities like that. This is something I've been practicing, like I said, for at least 6 years. So I didn't just wake up, this is what we're going to do. But I know it's possible. It just is possible. And if people can just start breathing, consciously breathing, noticing their breath for a month, maybe 2 to 3 minutes a day, the rest will actually start to take care of itself.
And can you talk a little bit more too about productivity and the cult of productivity?
Oh man, I love that you said cult of productivity. Yeah, performance culture, all of that. And this is how I shifted my thinking about it. It was 2015 and I was doing polarity therapy. I was in training for it and a class for it. And briefly, polarity, it's similar to Reiki in terms of body work and moving energy. The concept is if we can remove blockages, we can be well. But it's also connecting to ways to be healthy for yourself. And it can be lots of different things, but it's about having things in balance. Funny to return back to that word. But I remember we were doing a session and we were just sitting with people. And we were practicing like leaning in and like being absent, like too much in somebody's business, disappearing. And I remember saying, what am I supposed to do? I am supposed to be doing something. And my teacher was like, no, actually you're not. And I thought about it for a moment. And I'm like, in all these years as a social work practitioner, I've been feeling like I've had to do something, but I actually get to be someone. And that is completely different. So back to this, I'm being myself. I'm being in my own life, in my own radiance, right? And my own breath, all of these things. There's nothing more that I really need to do. I get to show up for people like that. And there is a difference when people show up, when they're grounded within themselves. And so we talked about productivity and feel like we always had to go and produce and perform. And like, I just learned that was exhausting. It's just exhausting. There's plain and simple, and I don't want to live that way. I'm a slow, I have slow feet almost all the time. I take my time with everything. I'm usually about 5 minutes minimum late for things. It's not intentional. I move a little slower, and I had to learn that that was also okay to process slower, to do things slower. Like I had to learn that and be able to rest in that because I felt like something was wrong with me because of our cult of productivity. And so what I would say to anybody who's a recovering perfectionist or high producer, I don't even want to use that word because I still produce highly, that's what you want to call it, is I had to shift my relationship with outcomes and what I'm attached to. And I'll use my social work lens as this, as social workers were taught we're supposed to fix people and do things for people. And one, I believe that we all have what we need within us. We just need people to give us the space for it to come out and let us know it's there. But two, I can't actually fix homelessness. I can't always find somewhere for someone to go. I can't do a lot of things. What I can do though, is honor their dignity. Right? I can look them in the eyes and say hello or connect them to resources. And so my attachment to outcomes has changed to it's not to the end result in the productivity way. It's Am I living in my values? Is my work oriented around the things that are important to me? That is, and that's where I get to rest because I'm in my sweet spot doing those things.
This has been, so we're both in Columbus, Ohio, and it has been a really rough year in Columbus. It's been incredibly difficult. We've had a lot of things, bad things happen in our community, and I know that other communities as well. And one of the things I've been talking about with clients is their sense of helplessness. I hear you really focused on, I've been quoting the TV show Angel to some clients, which is, if nothing we do matters, then all that matters is what we do. It's just, Buffy, Joss Whedon is a terrible man, but he made some good shows. I like what you're saying here, because you're talking about you do the work for the work's sake and not for a result, because that's it. A lot of the times the result is out of our control.
Yeah.
But the work is available to us.
It is. And what's interesting, two thoughts about helplessness. One is I'm a alpha female by all the word. I'm a Leo. I have all these great ideas and I want things. I'm an oldest child. So I've got all these beautiful gifts, as I'll say, but I want to control outcomes sometimes. I really do. I want to control how people feel. I want to control like what they're doing because I think I know what's best for them. That's part of my bigness here. And I also know that I can't, and that's unrealistic. And I think when we start to feel helpless, it's almost like, what did you think you were going to do? Really, like it's turning that question around, like, why did you think you're going to be able to solve this in the first place? But another thing, and I talk about this in a lot of the DEI stuff, is around resistance. And there's an emotional resistance that we have, and it comes up in like helplessness, anger, anxiety, shame, guilt. And there's a cognitive resistance and behavioral. And the behavioral is also this sense of helplessness and the problem being too big. I don't know what to do. And it honestly is back to our nervous systems and our adaptive strategies. It's how we get immobilized because we don't know what to do, right? And so we turn outward away from an issue, or we say we can't do it. And then we get stuck. So I always invite folks to get into this and space of I can't fix anything. And there's one thing I can do. And maybe it's caring for myself. But no, I think helplessness is also, there's this book, it's called Trauma Stewardship. And helplessness is also part of a trauma response. So it's almost like we convince ourselves that there's nothing we can do to fix ourselves or get out of a situation. And then we then perpetuate that and stay in that situation. And that's not to blame people by any means. I love knowing why my brain does what it does. It's very grounding for me. And in fact, when I first started doing trauma work, I would read a lot of theory so I could understand things. But doing the work for the sake of the work absolutely takes away, I think, the option of helplessness sometimes. That doesn't mean you're never going to feel it. It just means you don't get stuck there. You don't rest there.
Helplessness is a trauma response. That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
And for people listening, sometimes the sense of helplessness is protective. So I'll use my son as an example. I mean, I know he's fine with me sharing parts of his story in general, but because he had such a hard time in school, IEP, learning disabilities, he definitely developed a learned helplessness, I call it, but wouldn't even start doing things because he didn't want to fail. But he felt like he couldn't do it. So again, back to that cycle. And so I want to make sure there isn't like this sense of blame or negativity on top of helplessness. And sometimes it's just real. There's nothing you can do. So let's own it and figure out what is available to do.
A whole lot of what you're talking about is self-acceptance. You learn to understand yourself so you can accept yourself. And I wonder if self-forgiveness is something there too that you're talking about.
I would say, perhaps. I think for me, the practice of radical acceptance in general is definitely it. Like it's accepting what is before I even try to change or do anything about it. And grace and expansion, like giving myself room to have the full experience of a human. And yeah, there is a level of forgiveness and grace there. But sometimes I think we get tricked into believing there's something to forgive and we didn't do anything wrong. And that's why I'm pausing around the word forgiveness, especially I know folks who are harder themselves and I should have, or I did this wrong. And even around parenting, oh, man. And so I don't know if I've forgiven myself or felt like I've had to in some areas. I definitely have grace because I think about, what would I say to somebody else? And I'm probably not going to be as hard on them as I am myself. But shame and guilt and needing to forgiveness is also, honestly, it's an adaptive thing. We're taught to feel that way. And then when, again, back to the intersections, because all of this is really connected, depending on how we're socialized, our family beliefs, our faith, all these different things, we get caught up in that. And I think it can be confusing. What's wrong? What do we need forgiven for? How do we forgive ourselves? And so I think that's forgiveness for ourselves is necessary and really nuanced.
Ooh, gosh, that's some heavy stuff. That's some heavy lifting you got people doing there.
No, that's why I say breathe.
I hear what you're saying, because I think we talk about we're going to make mistakes as parents.
Yeah.
The difference between, I tell the people who are members of the site or and clients, the difference between us and our parents is often that we're willing to acknowledge our mistakes.
Yes.
And work on repair.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, though, that whether or not our children forgive us for whatever we did is truly up to them. It so belongs to them. We can acknowledge the things we did that caused harm while still acknowledging we did the best we can. Like, it's not one or the other.
Exactly.
And the reason the site is called You Are Not Your Mother is I would say that to clients all the time because they're so afraid of doing that kind of harm. Yeah. But I think the fact that they're already being reflective and trying to do it differently means they are not going to do that kind of harm.
Absolutely. And so attached to outcomes can apply in every area of our life. You know, as a parent, I want my children to know they belong in this world, whether they ever fit in, that they are on purpose who they are, and that they are loved deeply and endlessly, no matter what. And I've been telling them this since they were young. There's nothing you can do to make me stop loving you. And I even say that to them now as young adults. And it's to the point where they're like, we know. And I'm like, yes, I did my job. I want them to be annoyed with how much I love them. And all the other stuff, like, yeah, there's bumps in the road. I am not above apologizing to my kids. I never have been. I think that's one thing that as a parent in this generation, we get to do differently is I messed up. Or I've said to my son in particular, because we've had the highest conflict is I actually meant what I said, or these are my concerns. I didn't mean the way that I said it because it's important for me to hold your dignity, mine and yours at the center of this. And I wasn't holding your dignity when I spoke to you that way. And so I'm also teaching him who he is. I'm reflecting back to him that you are still worthy of your dignity to be held, even if you're doing really dumb things, right? And so those are outcomes. That's a shift that I had to learn to make as a parent. If I misspoke or made a mistake, do I forget things? Yeah, my daughter's been bugging me about a dentist appointment for multiple months now. And she knows how much I love her and it's so deep and there's nothing that can break that. And there's an amount of safety here that she gets to experience that I don't know that I did as a kid. And so when I think about parenting differently, I've had to reframe what that actually looks like and what that means. So we get to define that for ourselves.
I'm thinking about Anne Lamott in one of her, I think it's operating instructions, but I'm not sure. She writes about that there were never enough Band-Aids in her house. They're only the little tiny ones. And so she always had a lot of tension around Band-Aids. She would get activated around Band-Aids. And her therapist said, go buy all the Band-Aids that you need. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's a couple things there. And one is that sometimes our children will find things upsetting or traumatic that we didn't see. We didn't realize that not having Band-Aids was upsetting for them. And two, and I don't know much about, I haven't read enough of her memoirs to know all about her childhood. I think it was pretty chaotic and a lot of addiction. But we can also allow our children to have that experience. We don't need to be defensive about why we didn't have Band-Aids. We don't need to freak out and tell them that they didn't need Band-Aids anyway. Why are you whining? We can just accept that for them that was difficult.
Yeah.
It's this tricky balance.
Right.
It doesn't mean we have to condemn ourselves to allow our children to have this experience?
No, her parents, and I don't know anything about it either, but there's probably other things they were worried about. It makes me think about a time last year with my son, and we were just having a conversation, and I raised my voice back, and he was like, "Why are you yelling?" And I was like, "I don't know." And then we just both started laughing. I don't know why. I was just activated. I don't know. But like, we moved on from it. And I think being back to that, giving grace and just being honest sometimes. And again, it's age appropriate honesty. And I don't discuss everything with them. You know, you might see there's this wall back here with not a lot of art on it. I've been depressed and trauma healing for 2 years since we moved here. And my daughter keeps asking, like, why don't you have our pictures up? And I was just like, I'm just now getting around to decorating the house because depression is really heavy and exhausting. And she can hear that at her age and it's okay, right? And it's important for her to know that. Or I could have just been like, would you stop asking about the dumb pictures? Like, I could be that way. Mm-hmm. And then she gets shamed or whatever it is for asking questions versus me just being able to give her an answer. That's the truth.
And she feels safe enough to ask you that question.
Exactly.
Yes. That's a big deal.
Yep.
I hope that everybody listening, because I know a lot of the people listening have younger children. You and I, my kids are 17 and 24. Yours are 17 and 19. We're here to tell them that you don't have to be perfect to be a good mom.
No.
That motherhood, it feels like when you're in the moment, especially when they're small, it's always going to be like this, but change is inevitable.
Yeah.
That balance is a myth. Mm-hmm. And that if you can care for yourself, you will also be caring for your children.
Yes, I would say caring for myself is one of the best things I ever chose to do. And not to say that I wasn't, but I was intentional. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, oh, I'm tired, I need to do this. It was like, no, I'm going to do this. And to one point, as parents, as apparently I get lots of feedback from my kids. But I remember them being like, you don't even seem like you want to be a mom. And I said, why? And they were like, you do self-care things, you have friends. And I was like, yes, I do. Yes. And there was nothing else to explain. And I love that they got to see that. And I'm sorry that it impacted them the way that it did. I feel sad that they felt like I didn't want to be a parent anymore. And I'm disappointed that I missed things. And my God, I feel really good though. And I'm my favorite version of myself when I'm caring for myself. And I want them to have that part of me as well.
So how can people find the Rest Collective? How can they get connected to what you're doing?
We are on Instagram at the Ohio Rest Collective. Our website is www.theohiorestcollective.com. And we're also on Facebook as The Ohio Rest Collective.
And can people access services through you? If they wanted some of this leadership training or something, how would they do that?
They could, whether it's on social media, send it through a private message. That's fine. Our email is also included in both of our social media sites, which is theohiorestcollective@gmail.com. But if you go to our website, there's a tab that says contact and they can send a message there. And we do no cost consultations, free consultations for whether it's for leadership training organizations or to work with me, the Rest Doula.
Oh, okay. So good. That's great. So if somebody didn't, I think some people are leaders, don't realize that they're leaders, but somebody could connect with you if they wanted to just learn more about to get some doula rest work.
Yes, actually, it's a consultation and I talk to them and figure out what their goals are and then we put a plan together.
Oh, I love that. Okay. I really appreciate you talking with me today. I'm going to make sure all your socials, the website are in the show notes so that people can make sure to get there. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for doing this and thanks for holding the space today.
My gosh, I just feel more relaxed after listening to Erin. It was a great interview. I loved getting to talk with her and I liked re-listening to it for edits too. I didn't edit it very much. She's a wonderful speaker. There's something so calm about her, right? It really made me think about the very first podcast I did this time last year with Eve Herman, who's a licensed massage therapist and somatic experiencing practitioner. And she spoke about presence. I feel like the two podcasts are very complementary. Both of these women have such a way about them that whenever I'm with them virtually or in person, there's such a calm about them. There's such a centered confidence, and it makes me enjoy being in their presence. Anyway, I hope you listen to Eve's podcast if you haven't, and I hope you enjoyed Erin's. I wanted to make sure that you know how to follow the Ohio Rest Collective. You can find them at theohiorestcollective.com. You can also find them on Instagram at the Ohio Rest Collective. And you can go to their site to learn more about them and what they have to offer. You can add them to your Instagram feed for inspiration and encouragement. And I hope you'll do both of those things. Also, if you are a member of Child Anxiety Support, I am going to remind you that Eve is in our membership every month offering a stress reset practice. Just to make sure that you know how to find Eve. Also on Instagram, you can find her at Source Embodiment, all one word. You can learn more about her practice. And then if you'd like, you can become a member of Child Anxiety Support and get access to her monthly practices along with a host of courses and live Zoom Q&As and lots of support, particularly for parents of anxious kids. I thank you so much for joining me this month and hope to see you next month. Meanwhile, you take care. Bye-bye.